One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. There are few men in Israel whose demise would be mourned by a larger circle. He has endeared himself to the hearts of the Latter-day Saints throughout the world. His work has been a great one, and nobly has it been accomplished. I feel that he was assuredly foreordained to his labor as a teacher in Zion. His place is not to be taken by another. Such were the words of Elder James E. Talmage, not about the passing of a prophet, but of a teacher, Carl G. Mazur. And here to talk about the life of Carl Mazur is educational philosopher and biographer A. LeGrand Richards, also known as Buddy Richards. Buddy, thank you. Glad you're here to join us on Legacy today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get going, I'd like to get to know you a little bit better. Tell us a little about your personal and professional life, if you would, please.
Well, I've been in education for quite a long time. My background's actually in educational philosophy. Had a chance to study at Harvard and BYU, and have been at BYU for, I think I taught my first class in 1982, and spent a couple of years in Germany at the University of Würzburg teaching the Institute for Pädagogik. And then I've been back at BYU since in different departments, currently in the Educational Leadership Department. I've been there for a number of years now, and I enjoy that side of my life deeply.
And are you from around Utah?
I'm from Bountiful originally. Grew up there and served a mission in Scotland.
Very good. Well, with the name LeGrand Richards, there must be a link to the other LeGrand Richards we all know and love. Tell us about that.
He's my grandfather, and been quite a handle to carry around. Been a great legacy, though, to carry it all by itself. I can't even pull out a credit card without people telling me stories, so it's wonderful.
Well, as long as we're telling LeGrand Richards stories, I was had received my mission call, was walking down the street in downtown Salt Lake City, and Elder Richards was just coming down the steps of the administration building, and I said, do you mind if I shake your hand? And he had an umbrella in one and a cane in the other. He says, well, they're all busy, but I think I can probably make do. It was very exciting for me. Well, you're currently working on a biography of Carl G. Mazur. Why did you decide to take on such a monumental task?
Well, I've been interested in some of the procedures in education for a long time, and got looking at issues about grading, for example, and thought, well, I should add the BYU story to that issue. And in doing that, I ended up reading the faculty meeting minutes from the beginning of the school. I just kind of fell in love with this figure. I could see that his vision for education was really great, and so I started looking a little more fully what was there. And there's remarkably little that actually details his life. You've got a book by his son Reinhard. It was written, and it's a wonderful tribute with some family stories mostly, but it's not placed in a very rich context of either his educational preparation or his kind of contributions in a larger sense than what you'd get from a family member. There's also a little book by Alma Burton, the master's thesis turned into a book, and that's about all there is in terms of the actual detailing of his life. So I thought, my goodness, somebody needs to do this.
It's past time.
So I felt, and I kind of felt tuggings, I suppose, from both sides of the veil. I've got Franklin D. Richards, the one who baptized him, was a great-great-grandfather of mine, it ties in. His life has been one that it's kind of almost plagued me. That says you've got to do something with this more fully.
Very good. I believe most people who grew up in Utah probably have some connection with Carl Mazur, whether through his legacy of teaching or as an elementary student in Provo, Utah. I, along with thousands of other children through the decades, attended Mazur Elementary School.
Did you? How wonderful.
And I think that's my one connection to this giant of a man. And your connection with your great-great-grandfather, that's quite amazing.
The chalkboards that were in that school, we actually have them now at BYU. They were actually just chalkboard paint painted on the plaster. And when the school was given to the housing authority, I knew the director fairly well and said, "What are you going to do with the chalkboards?" And he said, "We don't know. If you've got a good purpose, they're yours." So I had the chance to figure out how you take off a chunk of plaster from the wall without erasing the chalk that's on the outside of it.
Wow.
But it was a wonderful project. But it's a great legacy to keep. And you know what those things feel like now, because if you went to that school, undoubtedly yes. You had a chance to look at them.
Yes. I feel generally we know the Carl G. Mazur of later years, the great teacher, the mentor, the administrator, better than we know what brought him to that point. So if we may, today, I'd like to focus a few minutes on those early years that really shaped who Carl G. Mazur would become. Born in Germany, tell us about the political and educational climate of the Germany into which Carl Mazur was born.
Well, he was born in 1828 in the little town of Meissen, just about 15 miles down the river from Dresden. His father was a master painter at the famous porcelain factory. They probably make the most expensive porcelain in the world still, gorgeous stuff. So it wasn't really an aristocracy that sometimes happens, but it was. He was living in a time that lots of tensions had been occurring. There was a real push for education. Some of the philosophers had convinced the King Frederick the Great that we need to have a great nation, and that means they need to be enlightened. So they had a concept of general education that started to span out. Really been interested in the works of Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi from Switzerland, who had a different kind of concept. He actually spent most of his life preparing orphans. But this Germany decided we should send some of our best and brightest to work with Pestalozzi and come back and set up a teacher training programs. So they did that in numerous places in Germany. It brought a very different kind of concept to the country, but it also meant that the political scene was really a dramatic one. There were probably 30-some-odd countries that make up what we know of Germany today. They each had their king, a monarch of some sort. They tended to be fairly related to one another. They had their own aristocracy and their lower class, and it was quite distinguished in terms of the class distinctions, and anything but democratic. In the 30s and 40s, as this climate started to shift, and there was more of an emphasis to try to say, we'd like to have some of the freedoms that we know that some of the other countries have had. The issues of freedom of press, freedom to assemble, freedom to choose your career. Some of those kinds of issues became much more of a dramatic push. People wanted to have those freedoms, and they wanted to see a more unified Germany that would have a democratic constitution and participation in parliament. So Carl was raised in a climate that started brewing these ideas that maybe democracy is not such a horrible thing, and some of those kind of ideas, the ideas of Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi, were particularly important in the educational setting. And they set a tone that would say that man has a greater potential than just the social class to which they are assigned. And I think that affected him deeply. He was a good student. He attended a school in Kern, which is a little town kind of a suburb of Meissen. Just 3.5 years that we have listed in that particular school. Apparently, he's a good student. And his family knew that upon graduation as a 14-year-old, it wasn't sufficient. So they sent him to a prep school in Dresden, the Kreuzschule. It was a famous – it's been around a long time. That, in fact, it had some really famous people like Wagner was there just a few years earlier. And primarily it was a traditional prep school that would teach them Latin and Greek and prepare them so that they could take a position in the university. He did well in that school, but for some reason he chose not to go to the university. He instead went to the Friedrichstadt Schullehrerseminar, which was a teacher training college, one of these colleges that had been designed and to build on this Pestalozzian idea.
So could he have gone to a university? Do we know why?
Yeah, no question he could have. The question that happens whether there was enough the reason we don't know why he didn't I mean, he did well enough in the school that he certainly could have gone to the university. But whether it was because you had to have more money to go there than the family could put together, or whether there was a scholarship that was offered to some of the sons of Meissen, of the way it was worded, for the Friedrichstadt School at Teachers College. And he may have gone there on scholarship in regard to that opportunity. And it may be they just said, if I want to be a teacher, the best place is not at the university, but in fact at one of these teacher training colleges, which would make some sense. He obviously was wrapped up in some of this democratic movement. I don't know how – we don't know exactly how much. He does make some references later on that he was familiar with some of the aspects of revolutionaries. Having participated in something like that myself, he said something – he writes on one of his missions.
So much like we're familiar with college students here being active in causes.
And in fact, that college – that the teacher's college was very much involved with this democratic movement. He graduates in 1848, which – so he's 20 years old at this point. And that was the year that the tensions kind of exploded in Germany and many other places. It turned to violence. There was a revolt. It didn't happen in Dresden in 1848. They waited another year until Karl was out on his apprenticeship. His first kind of student teaching. They'd have a two to three year apprenticeship that they would go to. And so it he met in that kind of a setting.
What kind of a – let's just step back to his college studies. As a student, what would a typical day consist of for he and the other students in such a highly regarded educational system?
Well, as he got to – particularly with the teacher's training college, it was a very rigorous. They'd start up at 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning. Their day would be set out, the prayers that they'd have to give, and breakfast would be served at certain times. They actually ran a school on campus, so they would spend some of the day taking care of the students who would come and teaching them the classes. They had some very rigorous kinds of activities, although it was fairly open in lots of ways. They'd give them tasks and say, show us that you're competent to show us skills in these areas. So it was fairly open in that regard, but a very rigorous kind of thing. The tests are, in fact, after 3 years, it was only a small percentage of them that were allowed to go on further. So it was a very rigorous program.
Sounds like they wanted good teachers.
They wanted the best. And in fact, it became kind of one of those issues that said this is not a fallback issue, that if you don't get a job in the field, you go into teaching. This was one where they wanted the very best people to go there. And they seemed to have a pretty good crop that would come through.
Very good. We're talking today with A. LeGrand Richards, biographer of Carl G. Mazur today, and discussing the life of Brother Mazur. This is great stuff that I have never come across before, and so this is exciting to talk about. So he finishes his college studies, has to do an internship. Where does he go for this?
Well, it's not quite so clear exactly where he went. It sounded like he became a tutor for some Bohemian families. We're not exactly sure where that took place, but I don't think it was too far away from Dresden area. I know that he comes back in 1851, so it's just been a few years away, and is offered a position right in Dresden at the First District School. This is where he meets his father-in-law, who is the director of that school, or his father-in-law-to-be. I guess he starts spending a little extra time at the director's house than would normally be expected, because he had this interest in his daughter Anna. And very difficult arrangements, very formal ways to do it. I'm glad that we don't have to court that way, but they met and fell in love and were married, actually, just after Anna's father dies. He dies in December of 1853, and Carl, at that point, actually takes a position with the Budig Institute. This was a private school that was in Dresden, and I think he did it because what happened after the Revolution of 1848-49 is that the government blamed much of the revolution on the teacher training programs, and particularly this Pestalozzian influence.
They wanted enlightened people, but not too enlightened.
They didn't want them enlightened enough to actually expect more out of their society than what was going to be given. And there's a real concern that these people, as soon as they get a little education, they think they deserve more out of life. And there were some who said, let's squelch this whole democratic push by making sure that what happens in the schools is a lot more truncated. You know, where you only offer certain kinds of things. Just give them the skills. Don't give them reasons why and what's behind it. And so Carl is prepared for this great open liberal education to train students and to give them great ideas of what they can become. And then he comes back to a society that says, we don't want you to do that, but we'll hire you anyway. They had a real lack of teachers because there was an outgo of the intellectuals from Germany after that revolution. It was just enormous. Millions of people left and a lot of teachers. And so they were hungry to have teachers, but they were really worried about what they would be teaching. So he comes back into that kind of a climate.
One little side road, just for my personal interest. I'm kind of guessing that it's probably not a coincidence that kindergarten is not only a German word, but perhaps part of the philosophy of this time.
Absolutely.
Where did kindergarten come from?
Kindergarten is actually Friedrich Froebel, who was one of these Pestalozzian educators, who believed that... he had a terrific philosophy in a lot of ways to look at. He believed that in everything there was a law or governing mission, and it was a divine one. In fact, that was God working within them, and that it was the task of everything to try to fulfill that natural law, and that man was different in that we could become conscious of the law within us, the mission that we have to fulfill, and choose to fulfill it. And education, then, would be the task of helping us to become aware of that and to make it happen in actuality. So kindergarten, the garden of children, is where this growing and developing takes place. It's interesting, 1851, the kindergartens are banned as this atheistic institution. Well, but it was.
Wow.
They were trying to squelch this question of a democratic vision of what's potential of humans.
Well, this seems like a good segue to... what the educational philosophies of the time, whether they were a complement or a contradiction with the religious views of the day in Germany?
Yeah, that's a good question to raise. In some hand, they were both. Were deeply religious in terms of the potential of the human being, but not very consistent with traditional Lutheran catechism and the way that you teach children. Those tended to be very rigid and very authoritarian. Would challenge the young people to hold still while they're learning and getting their lives shaped into the proper form and answering only the right questions and asking only those kinds of ways. So it was, on the one hand, it was like this window of enlightenment that just kind of opens up and slams shut. And, of course, that opening is when Carl is prepared, and it's slammed shut just after he's prepared. So in some sense, it sets the tone for a very different vision of what's possible. And, in fact, they did it by requiring the teachers to teach a certain number of hours of religion every week. And, of course, Carl at this point was a little bit agnostic. I wasn't sure he believed anything, so he was kind of searching, what can I teach in these hours that have to be taught that I can do with integrity? And I think that's where he comes across an anti-Mormon book. And it just somehow enlivens him in such a way that he cannot leave it. It was a book by Moritz Busch. It's 158 pages. And Busch's work was really an interesting kind of a contrast. He writes with a very bombastic conclusions, but very careful details. And so he has all kinds of details about what the Mormons believed. And then he says, but only in America could such stupidity be institutionalized. And Carl sees through this in a way that just drives him. It awakens something inside of him that he cannot even quiet. It's like, I know that this man is a liar. You cannot do all these wonderful things that he's telling them they're doing and be as depraved morally as he's claiming them to be. So this book just enlivens him in a way that's truly unusual and remarkable.
Mormonism had not been around that long for this work to have been made available. How did it come about?
Well, there have been a number of efforts to try to get the message of Mormonism into Germany, but you can just imagine after Revolution, they were particularly cautious of any foreigners coming in. In fact, some people thought that the whole idea of this communistic and democratic movements that led to the revolution were brought in by foreigners. So the church had never been able to get a foothold in any of the German countries. There have been some efforts in Hamburg. But Saxony, they sent a man there once, and he got as far as the border, and they kicked him out. So in Saxony, there was absolutely no members of the church. There had been no contact. The literature wasn't legal to have. So this is a really remarkable kind of a story in some fun ways.
Let's talk about the early church growth in Germany. There was such phenomenal growth in Britain. I can't imagine they didn't have hopes for Germany, but with the current political climate, it was virtually impossible.
Yeah, that I think they were disappointed a number of times. A number of efforts have been made. Orson Pratt had spent some time there. Orson Spencer tried to make some inroads, took a copy of the Book of Mormon and got as far as the King's Court, and they arrested him and threw him out, said, what are you doing here? He thought he was actually there under an invitation because the king had expressed something that sounded like it would be an invitation to hear something about the church in Prussia. But it has been stymied, and every time it would be attempted. Of course, and it's difficult to find good people who could speak the language. Missionaries would be called to England. They'd say, we need to have a mission president. So they'd sent, like Daniel Tyler, was sent to Switzerland to be in charge of the Swiss-Italian-French mission.
Wow.
Didn't speak any of the languages. And instantly he was, oh, my goodness, what do we do? And he tried to get missionaries there. And in Switzerland was much more open, at least legally, to have missionaries than any place else. But they were getting arrested and banned and beat up. So we hear the story of William Budge, who actually ends up come to be a teacher of Carl later on, spends 7 months in Switzerland, is arrested 13 times, thrown out of all the cantons that he tried to work with, was beaten up a couple of times, and so they sent him back to England to say, well, finish your mission there. But he's the one that is actually asked to come to say, we've got these inquiries that happened from Carl Mazur. We don't know if it's real or not, but would you be willing to go check it out? This is where the story is. Carl finds somehow a copy of some kind of an address of John Van Cott, who'd been called to do a similar kind of thing in Denmark with the Scandinavian countries. And he writes to Van Cott, who says, well, he writes back to him and says, we don't really handle the German languages, so write to Daniel Tyler in Switzerland. So he writes to Daniel Tyler on the 4th of July. This is a kind of a fun date for him. A lot of dramatic things happened to him on the 4th of July, which is interesting. He writes his first letter to Daniel Tyler on the 4th of July. Tyler gets it and doesn't believe it's real. It's so positive. I mean, how could this happen?
Especially in current Germany.
Yeah. I mean, from Germany, of all places, it's like, I don't think this could be true. It's got to be a ploy by the police to try to find out what activities we're planning there. So he sends it back without any reply at all. Carl gets it and says, what story here? So he forwards that letter and another letter back to John Van Cott in Denmark, who, you know, saying, you said he was going to send me all this information and stuff. He didn't. All I got was the letter back. And so John Van Cott writes back to Carl, say, give him another chance. He sends the letter forward again to Daniel Tyler, saying, I think this guy's really serious. Let's find out. It would be nice to get some inroads into this part of Germany. And then a flurry of correspondence takes place over the next few weeks. They can't answer the questions fast enough. So they decide that to ask William Budge if he'd be willing to go check out whether this man is really serious. Budge arrives on the 28th of September. The reception must have been so positive. He actually went as a student to try to learn German from Dr. Maser.
This was his way of actually getting in the country.
Yeah. And the fact that's what, you know, say, well, I want to be a student of his. He actually offered to house them while that happened. So he's allowed in that kind of a setting to do that. He writes to Daniel Tyler almost immediately and saying that this man is ready to be baptized. He hadn't even met a member of the church yet. But apparently it was such a warm reception. And so Tyler makes a copy of that and sends a letter to Franklin D. Richards in Liverpool, who just arrived from a three-week tour of the continent, working with members of the church, and he drops everything and says, "Oh, we've got to go check this man out." So he writes a letter to Brigham saying, "I'm leaving in 10 minutes. I'll tell you about both of my trips when I get back. Have a chance maybe to start the work in Saxony." Takes William Kimball with him. Kimball had gone with him on that previous tour as well, and he gets a letter saying, "Meet me in Hull tomorrow morning." He's like, "Whoa, that's an all-night ride." So he hops on the train and they meet and go across the German Sea and travel to Dresden. And Carl is baptized on the 14th of October. So it's a very condensed investigation. He meets his first Mormon on the 28th of September. He's baptized on the 14th. And his mind is one of those that, you know, he doesn't swallow anything easily. So it's just a remarkable preparation, both professionally and spiritually, that would say you have truth here, and this man is being plucked out for a reason.
As a reminder to our listeners, you're listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're talking today with Buddy Richards about Carl Maser. There were a couple of quite remarkable spiritual incidents that occurred to Carl around the time of his conversion. Can you relay those to us?
That's true. And you can imagine with something that intense that he really wants to make sure that what he's doing is approved of by the Lord. He says that as he came out of the water, they did the baptism in the middle of the night. In fact, if you think about it, Franklin D. William Kimball arrived in Dresden in the afternoon on the 13th. They clean up in the hotel. They invite Budge and this friend from the Buddhist Institute to come talk with them. They have an interview until about midnight. The next day is when they do it in the middle of the night in order to avoid the attraction of the police. Well, Carl basically says in his report of it, I prayed that the Lord would let me know that what I've done is right. And of course, as they went from the place of where they met, the home of the Mazers, to the place of the baptism, it's about a mile and a half walk. So they'd have to go across the bridge there in Dresden and down to a spot that they thought would be properly secluded in the river Elbe. They did the baptism at the nighttime. Carl, I found a wonderful little page in Franklin D's journal. He had actually had a pocket planner-like thing where he writes on one page, I read it, and had the right dates, the October of 1855, bought some shirts and things. And the next page, it had someone practicing the alphabet in the German cursive. And on the next page, it had two versions of the baptismal prayer. The first one was one that was written obviously by someone who didn't know German very well. Misspellings, the words weren't quite proper, the grammar was wrong. And on the next page was one that was cleaned up in a beautiful German, and with Carl's G, from when he says Holy Ghost, that G is Carl's, I'm sure of it. So it's kind of fun to see in Franklin D's journal the actual prayer that I think they used for his baptism. Franklin D gave it in German, though he didn't really speak the language. He'd had some exposure to it. But as they came out, as they left the home to walk down to the baptismal place, they, of course, Carl was asking questions of President Richards, and he would answer them, and William Budge had to be the interpreter through both directions. So, you know, his German was not that great, but he made his best attempt, I'm sure, to formulate the question and then to translate it back into the language with the answer. And they'd done that all the way from the place, from the Mazer home to the place of baptism. On the way back, they started to do the same thing, and Brother Mazer said, you don't need to translate that. And so he asked the question, and President Richard says, you don't need to translate that. So they had this conversation in German and English all the way back across the bridge, when at some point the gift was gone again. Carl said, what was that all about? And he recognized that that was, in fact, the gift of the interpretation of tongues that they'd had with that experience. And it's one that stuck with him quite strongly for the rest of his life. Franklin D. speaks of it as well. What a great blessing it had been that they'd had this conversation all the way across the bridge and talked about issues in the priesthood and with each one of them perfectly understanding one another. And those others who were there witnessed it as well, that we watched that happen. A similar kind of experience happened on the next Sunday when they formed a branch on the 21st of October. And they made Carl the branch president. They ordained him an elder after a week. He gave instruction. President Richards gave instruction to the members that were there. They'd also added some extra. They had three baptisms that first night and then five later. And so he gave some instructions, and he'd give them in English, and Carl would give them in German, and William Budge would act as to confirm the accuracy of what was being said. So it was a blessing that all of them experienced in that branch on that day.
Another incident I read about in your writings was while he was waiting in a garden room, and he had a conversation with himself, which later proved to be another quite spiritual experience.
Yeah, this was an occasion that he writes. Actually, he doesn't write it. He tells it to a group. It was fun. In 1872, there was a group of tourists that came to Salt Lake, and their tour guide somehow had left the country. So they were kind of stranded trying, what do we do now? So they went through the address book, and they found the name of a German name, and it said Elder Professor, and they thought, we've got to meet this guy. So they went on a coach ride and found Carl teaching a class, and he meets them and says, well, wait until after my class, and I'll take you on a tour. Well, through this tour, they ask him, and he talks about an experience that he had much earlier. This had been when he was the tutor for that family in Bohemia, that he went to a garden room and was waiting. The children apparently weren't available yet. And so he sat there. And as he sat there, there was a reflection that happened in his mind where he saw himself speaking to someone, a foreigner, as he crossed a bridge. And at first the conversation was just about general things, and they started talking about religion. And it was this experience that happened again. He was like, imagine my surprise and my gratification when I, in fact, had the chance to experience that for real. And so I think he was referring to that. He had some kind of a premonition of the experience that he was going to have crossing that bridge with Franklin D. Richards.
President Richards.
Yep.
Very good. So he is converted. What was life like for Carl and other Latter-day Saints in Germany at this time?
Oh, my goodness. This was a city of snoopers and informants. There was such paranoia about everything that to try to keep the church alive and going, it was a real challenge from the outset. You have to keep it quiet to try to stay. You know, you couldn't meet too openly, but he wanted to share this message. He was so filled with it. He wanted to see the joys and share that with all of the members that he could, all of the people that he knew. His family didn't seem to be very receptive, except his wife. But they tried to grow the church as best they could, getting very little help from any outside, as you can imagine. William Budge stayed for a couple of weeks after the baptism, but he had to leave shortly thereafter. And the pressures were just great to try to say, how do we try to grow the church without causing serious problems with everything? I mean, they had to take an oath, for example, that they would teach only Lutheran doctrines as a teacher. So that became an interesting problem for them to say, what if I don't believe this anymore? What do I teach in the school? The children were supposed to be baptized. In fact, there was a fine for every day that if they weren't baptized by a certain date in the Lutheran church, it would cost them $1 a day or something. Yeah, from the parents. It was also true about the attendance. You had to attend a certain number of church meetings per year or you would receive a fine. So the mix of church and state was a really difficult period. And, of course, the Mormons had a horrible reputation as it was spread. And so it was a real challenge. They kept the church alive as best they could till about May of 1856, when the police became aware that there was a congregation of Mormons formed in Dresden. And it was an alarming thing to discover. In fact, a lot of people didn't believe it at first that it could be possible. William Budge Edward Schoenfeld, who'd joined the church with Carl, his family and most of the members of the church actually left in June. Carl stayed a little bit longer. Apparently, he was brought in to the police and given basically the choice of leaving this new religion of his or everything else that he had loved. And he chose at that point to pack up his bags and, in fact, on the back of his birth certificate, it says he was handed over to Liverpool by the Dresden police. So he was actually escorted to the border and said, get out of here. So he and his pregnant wife and his two-year-old show up to Liverpool saying, now what do we do with our lives? And they called him on a mission, which he did to serve. He served in London at that point had a chance to associate with people like Charles W. Penrose and some others who were serving in the London area at that time. They took up a fund, actually, to the members of the church there, as poor as they were, to support these exiled Germans for at least their mission. But it was really a dramatic time to leave his family, to leave his language, to leave his profession that he'd worked so hard to get ready for. But he knew that this was the truth. And he wanted to do whatever the Lord would have him do next.
As you say, he wasn't long doing nothing. Here he was in exile, but they gave him things to do rather quickly.
Absolutely. It's like, well, okay, if you're here, let's put you to work. He was called as a missionary to the German speakers in London. And, of course, at that point, you can imagine the kinds of people that were hanging out in London. Those that had been exiled for political reasons, those that were there because they couldn't stand what was happening to the government and the reaction. Karl Marx was he's making his trek to the British Museum every day, just a few blocks from where the saints were meeting. So it was quite a dramatic time with very extreme opinions. It's pretty hard to grow the church there as well because of those extreme opinions. But it's an interesting time period. There was a spy, for example, that was checking on Karl Marx, had been a mate of his in school, who ends up writing a book about the British concept of freedom. And so the test case of all of this is how they treat the Mormons. And he has about 70 pages talking about Mormonism, which I got to believe that the guy who was spying on Karl Marx was also checking on Karl Mazur during that year, because that was the year that he published this book. So there's a really interesting time that when the press found out that there had been two educated people who actually joined these Mormons in Dresden and were trying to keep a group together, it spread all over in the major newspapers can you believe it? They're not all idiots. There's actually a few that are educated. And they even took their wives with them. Apparently, the wives have no idea what their husband's real intentions must be, those kinds of comments. It was really interesting to follow that in the press. When it first came out, there was even one of the major newspapers says, no way. We checked into it. There are no Mormons in Dresden. And then 2 days later, a reply comes back, yes, there are, and we have verification of it. And so it was quite a dramatic start, but understandable that there's – the way I see it is this man was prepared in a unique and powerful way to make a contribution that only he could make, and the church sorely needed a vision of what the education of man should be. So his preparation spiritually and professionally were such an important part of that.
So how long before they made the trek to Utah?
Well – apparently, the Schoenfelds left in 1856, 57, and early, and I think they all wanted to go together, but they felt like Carl was needed to keep this mission going. Orson Pratt had made a prophecy that Germany would receive the church message primarily by those who are outside of Germany who bring the message back to them. This was a meeting that was held as they formed a German-speaking branch in London in October of 1856. And Carl must have felt that one deeply, that was his calling to make happen. But they were going to have a baby right away. The baby came either in March or April of 1857. And they needed to stay a little bit longer. So they left later enough in the season that it would have been too late to make it all the way to Salt Lake. The Schoenfelds made it all the way to Salt Lake that year, but they had to stop in Philadelphia, and of course, 1857 was a tough year for the church in lots of ways. The Mormons were being accused of all kinds of horrible things, and the Utah War was brewing, and so they tried to shut down almost all the immigration that year. So Carl was basically stranded in Philadelphia until 1860, when he finally gets enough to be able to come. Apparently, he was a branch president during that time. It's a hard time to find almost any information about his life and a really difficult time for the church, as you can imagine.
Is it possible to measure what influence Karl Mazur's had on not only the education in the West, but the church as a whole?
You know, that's a great question to ask and to think about, because it's... His impact was a deep one personally, but it was one that also brought vision in a really profound kind of way. As he got to Salt Lake, he started a school, and the school actually is severely damaged in an explosion in 1876. And he goes to Brigham, and Brigham, of course, gives him the charge that's been quoted so often. Brother Mazur, you're going on another mission, and it's now to Provo. we've got this church school we'd like you to start up. And he gives him the charge, you are not to teach even the alphabet or the multiplication tables without the Spirit of God. That is all. God bless you. Goodbye. He takes that charge very seriously. And as he comes to Provo, the question becomes, how do we create an organization of education in the church that would be worthy of the mission of the church? I think that plagued him as he started to see it, and he'd work out what was happening in the academy, because he knew the academy was just the start of it. As great as it could be, he needed to find a way to spread this influence and this opportunity to all the church members possible. I had the chance of reading Franklin D's journal in 1887. This is before the church educational system was formed. And he writes that I had the chance to tell Brother Carl that his proposal for education in the church has been accepted. Well, that's an interesting thought, and especially knowing that the CES, church educational system, was formed in 1888. Carl's made the first superintendent. He still has to be the principal of the Brigham Young Academy until 1892, but he's also now given the charge to establish the education in the church in the widest sense possible. So every stake was to try to create its own academy or something close to it. And it was his job to help that to happen. So his influence in that alone, if you should say, well, and we've got five of those that become universities, was a huge one. But the vision of getting education out to the church members generally, with the way that they'd use the juvenile instructor and the efforts that were made in that dimension, it would bring education to from Canada to Mexico, and establishing schools and setting up a vision of what education should be. And he saw that it would have to be adapted to the local needs and to be adjusted as necessary, and that it would change dramatically over time to serve the purposes of the church most effectively. But his charge was huge, and he was so beloved. It's just incredible. I mean, I know that there are lots of stories out there talk about how harsh he was and things. I have a hard time understanding how someone could be so beloved as this man and have some of the stories that have been told about him be true.
What would you say is one of the more surprising things to know about Carl Mazur?
Most surprising things. I suppose for most people, they'd be surprised with his sense of humor and his the tenderness and the amount of freedom that he would allow his students to have. The Grand Theology class is the best example I can think of. It met once a week. Theology, you know, in the church, we're quite guarded by, and we want to make sure that only the proper doctrines are taught. Well, the way the class went forward, every student was to submit a question for the grand theology class, some kind of a theology question. Sometimes he'd coach them on what kinds of questions are better ones than others. But there was a committee of students that would review the questions, and they would decide which one would be addressed in the next meeting, and who would do the answering. Sometimes it was faculty, sometimes it was students. It was run primarily by the students themselves with Carl's coaching. So he would get up and make some comments about some things, and if there was corrections that needed to be made, he'd make some of those. But for the most part, he turned that over to them. They would conduct the meetings. They kept the minutes. His openness to not do for students anything that they could do for themselves, I think, would be a little bit of a surprise to a lot of folks.
There's a quote that he wrote on a chalkboard at Mazur Elementary that we referred to before that I'd like to read. He walked in, the year was 1900. I'm not sure when Mazur Elementary was built. Could you?
It was just a couple of years before that.
Just before that.
This was on Founders Day that he was invited to come in.
And this is just a year or so before his passing.
Yeah, actually, a few months.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
February.
And, so this quote... the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. This life is one great object lesson to practice on the principles of immortality and eternal life. Man grows with his higher aims. let not that is unholy enter here. And I just find that such a remarkable statement to be placed.
Yeah, these are four separate statements on the chalkboards that were there at the time. But each one of them carries with it such rich, and in fact, it really tells a lot of his story. You know, the quote from Proverbs shows his love of the Scriptures and the Word of the Lord. The quote that when he says that this life is one great object lesson, the object lesson in Petzolozzi's terms was not just a cutesy way to introduce a lesson, but in fact, a way of engaging students by looking at concrete and seeing the eternal purposes that are behind it. So when he brings that one in particular, brings his preparation from Petzolozzi together with his preparation from the restored gospel, it's an object lesson to practice on the principles of immortality and eternal life. That's a great summary of it. And those other two, the last one, let not his unholy enter here, became the theme of the Mazur school. Somehow it got erased, but that one did not survive. But it was the theme of the school for a number of years.
What else do I and our listeners need to know about Carl G. Mazur?
Well, I don't know. I love this man because of his remarkable faith, his dedication. He knew things well. There's a wonderful story that has been told that the sense of humor that sometimes comes out that we don't often recognize. Apparently he was late for a class once, which are very rare anyway. But one of his students must have had some clever idea to think, we'll bring in a donkey from outside and attach it to the lectern, thinking he was being really sneaky. And of course they had no idea how Brother Mazur would respond to this. He walks in and looks at it and assesses things quite quickly, what they were trying to do. And he says, that is right. When the teacher isn't here, it's best to get the wisest among you to take charge of the class.
That's priceless. You made reference to another quote about his word of honor. Do you have that handy that you could?
Well, you know, actually, we don't have it the way that it's quoted all the time. That was given in an address by Lyman in 1925. So this is a long time after he would have given it, although it's really common to the kinds of things that he might have said. He believed that honor was so essential that no matter what happens, if you give your word to something, you don't break it. It's just as flat out and simple as that, no matter what it would be. And I think that's probably true. So it's quoted a lot in that regard, but I'm not sure we have a verification of him actually saying those words in those terms. He had a lot of encouraging things to suggest to members of the church. They used to visit they had a home teaching kind of assignment for the academy. He'd send out the senior students to visit the younger students twice a month and come back to report on them. One of the meetings, he gave a really beautiful quote. He says, "You may not think that these visits are making much difference, but you know, if the insects of the ocean didn't do their job, there'd be no coral reefs." That our little tasks, the little things that we do, you know, the more and more you understand what the role of coral reefs in the whole survival of this planet, the more you can appreciate the kinds of things that he would notice and the way he would use graphic images to bring ideas that are profound to light.
Wow. Thank you. I truly look forward to your finished book.
Yeah, so do I.
Carl Mazur.
I hope it happens.
Yeah. We have been talking about Carl G. Mazur today with Buddy Richards. Thank you very, very much for being here. It's really been a true pleasure.
Happy to be here. Thank you.